Hi, it's Graham Stoney here, and we're talking about self-confidence. And I have a really special guest with me here. His name is Dr. Russ Harris, and he's the best-selling author of The Happiness Trap, but he's also written a book on confidence titled The Confidence Gap: From Fear to Freedom. So I'm really looking forward to picking Russ's brains about the topic of confidence. So welcome, Russ.
Thank you.
So to get started, Russ, tell me, how would you define confidence?
Well, that's an interesting question because there's two popular definitions. By far the most common definition, the one that you'll find first in the dictionary, is confidence is a feeling of certainty or assurance. Mm-hmm. But there's another much older definition. Confidence is an act of trusting or relying, an act of trust or reliance. And that older definition goes right back to the Latin origins. Confidence comes from the Latin com fides, meaning with faith or with trust. And it's important to recognize these two definitions because the kind of action of trusting yourself or relying on yourself comes first. It is only through doing that over and over that one day you then start to develop the feelings of certainty or assurance in your own ability.
Okay, so you're saying the action comes first and then the feelings follow that.
Yeah, I mean, most people, when they talk about confidence, you know, when people say to me all the time, you know, I need more confidence, what they really mean is I want to feel certain, I want to get rid of these feelings of anxiety. They're talking about confidence as a feeling. Mm-hmm. But that's a very recent meaning of the word. You know, going back in history, confidence didn't refer to a feeling. It referred to a quality of behavior, a quality of action, the action of trusting yourself or relying on yourself, regardless of whether you felt totally calm and relaxed or whether you felt absolutely terrified, that quality. And so if we want to build confidence in any area of life, it begins first with action, the action of trusting or relying on ourselves to step out of our comfort zone, do something challenging. And it's only when we do that over and over and actually develop the skills and get the experience that we then start to develop the feelings of confidence.
Okay, that makes sense. So confidence comes from taking action.
Comes from taking action, stepping out of your comfort zone repeatedly. I mean, competence precedes confidence. It's unrealistic to feel confident about something if you're not first competent. Like, I'm learning to ride a bike now. I kind of started last year at the age of 43, and I've only been doing it sporadically, so my bike riding skills are not very good. I'm wobbling all over the place. It's unrealistic for me to expect to feel confident because I don't yet have the skills and the experience to be competent. When I've, you know, repeatedly ridden that bike over and over and over and can really kind of handle it well, then I may well start to get some feelings of confidence. But the point is, what I do is each time I trust myself, I have I kind of take action, trusting myself, relying on myself to get on the bike and pedal and do it, even though I feel really kind of fearful and anxious, and I have to do that over and over and over before I will kind of get those feelings of confidence. So the number one rule of the confidence game is the actions of confidence come first, the feelings of confidence come later.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So tell me, just going back a step, tell me, how did you come to be writing a book, The Confidence Gap? What led you to write that?
Well, as you mentioned, my first book, The Happiness Trap, was very successful, and my kind of career went in an interesting direction. I started running lots and lots of training for therapists and coaches and GPs and a variety of health professionals in the approach upon which these books is based. Mm-hmm. It's quite a sort of radical paradigm shift for most psychological professionals. This approach is popularly known as ACT, which mm-hmm. is an abbreviation for acceptance and commitment therapy or acceptance and commitment training. And what I would find is that lots of the folks who'd attended my workshops would say they really kind of loved the model and it had lots of great tools and techniques, but they didn't have enough confidence to use it. So that was one of the factors. The other is just my own personal journey. Like you, I have spent a lot of my life kind of struggling with a lack of self-confidence in many areas. And so I thought it was kind of interesting to draw on those experiences. And probably the third factor that influenced me is just it's one of the most common things that I see. You know, I work both as a therapist and as an executive coach, and lack of self-confidence is one of the most common things that people come to me for. So I just realized there was a huge need. And when I looked at most popular books on self-confidence, they all seemed to be about trying to control your feelings. They were all coming at confidence as a feeling and trying to control your feelings through positive thinking and self-hypnosis, and didn't really kind of acknowledge the reality that to develop those feelings, you're going to have to step out of your comfort zone and really learn a new way of responding to fear and anxiety, because on the journey of confidence, fear and anxiety is going to come with you.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say is the problem with those popular techniques? Because there's a whole bunch of self-help books out there that talk about positive thinking and those kind of things.
Well, I think the problem is that, you know, if you want to just give yourself a quick boost of self-confidence, then it's a bit of positive self-talk or listening to a self-hypnosis CD, you know, can really do that for sure. But when you're in a genuinely challenging situation, stepping out of your comfort zone into a challenging situation with an uncertain outcome, mm-hmm. all of those kind of feelings will just disappear. You're going to feel what people feel in challenging situations. You're going to have a fight or flight response. As a result of millions of years of evolution, this is what happens to the human body when you're in a challenging situation with an uncertain outcome. You have a fight or flight response. Your heart rate speeds up. Adrenaline levels rise. You get this voice in your head kind of warning you that you could get hurt or things might go wrong. And there's no way to kind of stop that from happening. What we need to do is learn a new way of responding to that fear and anxiety. You know, even the most successful, talented people on the planet will have the same feelings of fear and anxiety when they step out of their comfort zone. And the problem is the only way you can really develop genuine confidence is through stepping out of your comfort zone again and again and again. If we come back to the idea that competence precedes confidence, mm-hmm. how do you get competent at something when you're not already competent? You have to step out of your comfort zone, practice the skills, get the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can totally relate to what you're saying there. And certainly, I mean, the reason I became interested in the whole confidence thing, like you say, is because it's been part of my journey, not having it and working out, well, how do you get it? So, and that fight or flight response that you talk about, I can relate to how paralyzing that can be when you're in a situation where you want to act, but you've just frozen in fear. So how do you apply these ACT skills in those kind of circumstances to get past that?
Well, the thing is, it's not the fight or flight response or the fear or anxiety that paralyzes people or holds people back. What it is the way they respond to those thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
If you respond to those perfectly natural, normal thoughts and feelings, and I'm emphasizing natural and normal because in a lot of psychology books, feelings like fear and anxiety are referred to as negative emotions, as if there was something abnormal or unnatural about them, but that's what they're commonly called. And I think that's a great shame because, you know, you would be in trouble if you didn't have the capacity for fear and anxiety. We've evolved these responses to help us deal with challenging, uncertain situations. So it's not actually the fear and anxiety that's the problem, it's your attitude towards it. If your attitude is one of avoidance, I have to avoid these feelings, I have to get rid of these thoughts and feelings, I can't do the things that I really want to do until these thoughts and feelings have disappeared, then you're really stuck. You're stuck in what I call the confidence trap. The confidence trap is I have to feel confident before I do what matters. It's kind of, as long as you're coming at attitude of avoidance, these fear and anxiety is bad, thoughts about failing are bad, I have to get rid of them, they have to go away before I start taking action, you're in trouble. What we do in ACT is we teach people a new way to respond to these thoughts and feelings. Instead of an attitude of avoidance, we have an attitude of expansion. opening up and making room for these thoughts and feelings, allowing them to be there, dropping any struggle with them. So if I can just talk a little bit about mindfulness, is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
So mindfulness is a mental state of awareness and openness and focus, and has been known about in Eastern philosophy for thousands of years, but only relatively recently discovered by Western psychology in the last 20 to 30 years. And in the ACT model, we teach people mindfulness skills to handle fear and anxiety in a new way. In a state of mindfulness, you can have all the thoughts about failing or not being good enough, but you just kind of let them come and go like they're cars driving past outside your house. You don't get caught up in them. You don't get held back by them. In a state of mindfulness, you can have very strong feelings of fear and anxiety, racing heart, you know, sweaty hands, but you don't get held back by them, nor do you get into a struggle with them. You kind of just learn how to let them flow through you. Mm-hmm. And in many situations, you can actually channel that fear and anxiety into what you're doing and actually enhance your performance. You know, all top stage performers know this. If you talk to a rock star or a stage, you know, performer, an actor, they will all kind of ask them what it's like before they go out on stage. They're all going to have the same experience. They're all going to be experiencing that fight or flight response, racing heart, etc. But they're not likely to call it anxiety or fear. They're far more likely to call it being revved or amped or buzzed or wired or an adrenaline rush. And that kind of conveys a very different attitude towards these feelings. It's an attitude of openness or expansion, making room for this stuff. And they will channel it into their performance and enhance their performance. But from time to time, a stage performer starts to revert back to a relationship of avoidance. I have to get rid of these. And the stage performer might kind of say, oh no, these feelings are bad. I have to get rid of them. I can't have this racing heart. I can't have these thoughts in my head. I'm not going to go out on stage until all these thoughts and feelings have disappeared. And at that point, it becomes stage fright.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting what you say, because I've noticed myself that the feelings associated with, say, excitement and anxiety, the bodily sensations are actually very similar, you know, the heart racing, the whole blood pumping adrenaline rush thing. So I'm wondering how important it is, the labels that we use, like the language that we use, to say like I'm anxious rather than to say I'm excited.
Well, I think the labels do make some difference, for sure, but it's not kind of like a simple quick fix. It's not as if, you know, if you're feeling really anxious and you suddenly start saying I'm feeling excited, as if that's going to make a huge difference for most people.
Uh-huh.
It's just not that simple. But you know, one of the things that we teach people in mindfulness is how to recognize that thoughts and feelings are transient events passing through you. So if you use normal social convention and you say, I am anxious, mm-hmm. it makes it sound like you are that emotion. But suppose you were to say, I'm noticing feelings of anxiety, or I'm having the feeling of anxiety, or I'm having thoughts about failing. That helps you start to kind of separate and recognize that these are thoughts and feelings passing through you. They're not the whole of you.
Mm-hmm. So you don't end up being so attached to them, because you're not really identifying as that's what you are. It's just the sensation you're having.
Yeah. If you can, one of the things I like to do with my clients that complain that, you know, fear and anxiety is holding them back, is get them in touch with it in this state of mindfulness and have them look at all the different components. And what you'll find is usually there's one component is words and pictures in the head. There'll be words about not being good enough or failing or something going wrong. There may well be images in your head, and then you'll notice some sensations in your body, a racing heart or sweaty hands or knots in the stomach. And we'll have a look at each one of those components with a real kind of mindset of openness and curiosity. Let's have a look at these elements inside my body that I'm so trying so hard to avoid or get rid of, and let's see if I really need to fight with this stuff. Let's see how bad it really is. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of zoom in with that attitude of childlike curiosity and really notice what's happening in your heart and study it like a, you know, a curious scientist who's paid good money to have the opportunity to study this phenomenon and notice that heart racing and where it is and what temperature it is and what it feels like, or those knots in your stomach or that voice in your head. What you tend to find is that after you've done this, you realize that there's actually not one single element of fear or anxiety that is really bad or horrible or awful that I have to try and fight with or run away from. And you kind of learn how to make room for all of it. It's a very alien concept to Western culture. We live in a feel-good society that is obsessed with feeling good, obsessed with positive thinking, and we kind of taught from a young age that we have to get rid of feelings that are unpleasant or thoughts that are negative. And if we could do that, it would be fantastic. But I'm sure many of your listeners know full well that those strategies don't really work in the long term.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is, rather than trying to push away these feelings of fear and anxiety, adopt this sort of observer point of view where you're noticing what's going on and expanding your mindfulness or your consciousness to recognize that you're big enough to handle this anxiety and that it's all going to be okay.
Yeah, there's. I wouldn't say to someone it's all going to be okay, because you don't know. I mean, the whole point is you're stepping out of your comfort zone into an uncertain situation, and so, you know, again, some of the self-hypnosis programs will have you kind of tell yourself it's all going to be okay, it's all going to turn out for the best. But I think that's just setting people up for unrealistic expectations. You know, sometimes it will and sometimes it won't. Here's where we're back to the idea of confidence as an action. Confides not only means with trust, it also means with faith. From fides, we get the words like fidelity, being true to yourself. And so, you know, let's kind of be true to myself. Is this important? Is what I'm about to do, is it really important? Would I be being the ideal person I really want to be if I take this action? By definition, you don't know what the outcome will be. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an act of faith. So let's kind of take an act of faith. Let's step out of my comfort zone, take action, and let's just engage fully in what happens. Live in the present moment. Give my full attention to what is going on in this moment, rather than getting too caught up in what the ultimate outcome will be.
Mm-hmm. So being less attached to how things go and just going with what is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, obviously there's time and a place to kind of plan the future and set goals, but most people who lack self-confidence and certainly spend too much time obsessing about the future. Will I fail? Am I good enough? What's going to go wrong? You know, or trying to talk themselves into it. It'll all be fine. I'll be okay. You know, while that kind of self-talk comes naturally to us, it actually doesn't really help most people. Mm-hmm. Self-talk can be helpful, but I think you're better to have realistic self-talk. For example, might say, okay, I'm noticing fear, or I'm noticing anxiety in my body. I'm noticing that racing heart. Here's my mind telling me all the things that can go wrong. And then kind of reminding yourself, this is important. Whatever this action is, it's something that matters to me. It's meaningful to me. Of course, if the course of action you're planning to take is not meaningful or important, why are you bothering with it? Uh-huh. But if it is... But if it is important and meaningful, remind yourself of that. You know, is it in line with your values? Are you doing something that is important deep in your heart? And if you are doing something that's important deep in your heart, are you willing to make room for the fear and anxiety that's likely to accompany you on that journey?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the popular myths about confidence is that when you're really confident at something, then there'll be no more fear and anxiety. And that is just not the case. You know, Lance Armstrong is a really good example. Lance Armstrong, you know, one of the greatest athletes in human history, 7 times winner of the Tour de France. If you read interviews with Lance's teammates, his fellow cyclists, coaches, trainers, people that work with him, they all say the same thing. They say, Lance, he's so confident. He has no fear of failure.
Uh-huh.
That's what they all say, but that's not what Lance Armstrong says. You know, I've quoted him in The Confidence Gap, a lovely quote. He says, I fear failure. I have a huge phobia around failure. So not fear of failure, phobia of failure. Now, this is an incredibly confident guy with an amazing track record, and he still has a phobia of failure. The problem is that Lance doesn't say this very often. He, you know, in 99 out of 100 interviews, he doesn't talk about this. And because he doesn't freely talk about it, people around him assume it's not there.
In fact, do you think that could be part of what motivates him to train so hard to be so successful?
Absolutely. You know, this is kind of another way that, fear and anxiety can become our ally rather than our enemy. It can actually motivate us to practice the skills and get the experience and enhance our performance. So, you know, if I give you a personal example too, you know, I've been public speaking in one form or another since I was a little kid, and every week I'm flying around Australia giving talks to, you know, hundreds of people. And I'm very confident at public speaking, but that doesn't mean no fear, no anxiety. you know, when I get up on stage talking to people, I'm confident in my ability, and I'm also full of fear and anxiety. In fact, I very often start off by showing people my sweaty hands, because to the outside observer, I look totally calm and relaxed. But you know, part of my message is kind of normalizing that we all have these difficult thoughts and feelings, and people are often quite shocked when they see my kind of red, dripping, sweaty hands. You know, so you know, this is another part of the problem. We look at confident people, and we don't know what they're feeling inside, so we assume that they have no fear and anxiety,
when in fact they're feeling just all the same things that we are.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, another great paradox is the more that you try to avoid fear and anxiety, actually the bigger it gets.
Yes. So you can develop a phobia just by totally avoiding dealing with the fact that you're anxious in a certain situation.
Absolutely. I mean, that at the core of a phobia is avoidance. Think about it like this. Let's suppose that, first of all, let's just look at what psychology tells us. The most powerful treatment in the whole of Western psychology is exposure. That means putting yourself in direct contact with whatever it is you're afraid of until you get used to it. There is not one single intervention in psychology that has more dramatic effects on human beings. And we know that this is the gold standard of treatment for phobias. Gradually expose yourself to what it is you're afraid of until you kind of get used to that fear. And paradoxically, as you kind of get used to that fear, the fear actually reduces. So if my strategy is to stay away or avoid whatever it is that gives rise to fear and anxiety, then my fear is just going to get bigger and bigger. You know, this is why the Americans say, get back on the horse. You know, pulling off that horse, you're scared of getting back on it. The longer you wait, the bigger your fear is going to get.
So one thing about exposure therapy is the idea is that you progressively introduce more and more of the thing that you're afraid of. You don't just go out in one hit. I mean, are there risks that you could be more traumatized by overexposure?
Yeah, that's basically a very sensible principle. You just build up your tolerance, if you like. You bit by bit, you increase the risks that you take. In the ACT model, we do what's called values-guided exposure. So we get people to clarify their values. You know, what sort of human being do you want to be? What really matters to you? What's important deep in your heart? What do you want to stand for? You know, when you look back from your deathbed at the life you lived, what do you want to say that you stood for as a human being? And then use those values to set goals and guide your ongoing actions. So we wouldn't want you kind of putting yourself in anxiety-provoking or fearful situations unless it was aligned with core values, unless it was something meaningful and important that was, you know, contributing to your life, your life's journey, your well-being, your vitality. Then having clarified those values, then we just help people set a progressive series of goals aligned with those values that will pull them out of their comfort zone in an important, meaningful direction. And then we teach them mindfulness skills to handle the difficult thoughts and feelings that are guaranteed to show up with each step outside their comfort zone. So, yeah, it would be foolish, I guess, to, you know, take too big a jump. Although sometimes you can't help it. Life just forces that upon you. Sometimes, you know, crises happen or events happen and you get thrown in the deep end. But if you have some choice about it, then it makes sense to move, take small steps and gradually build up your capacity to handle fear and anxiety and take action. And another key factor in confidence is the ability to engage fully in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Task-focused attention, keeping your attention on whatever is relevant to the task at hand.
Uh-huh. So this is the notion of being totally present, right, while you're doing something?
Yeah, being totally present. You know, sports psychologists often use the term task-focused attention. If you look at a confident sportsman, confident tennis player or cricketer or whatever, what you find is that their attention is only focused on whatever is relevant to the task. Whereas if you look at the unconfident sports person, what you'll find is rather than task-focused attention, there's a lot of self-focused attention. I'm getting focused on the feelings in my body that I don't like. I'm getting distracted by thoughts in my head about not being good enough and how am I measuring up and am I coming across and am I performing well and will it be okay? And as my attention gets caught up in my own thoughts and feelings, self-focused attention, my performance inevitably goes down. In order to perform well, I have to have my attention on the task. Mm-hmm. So this is another key factor. And again, this is something that you can also learn through mindfulness skills, this capacity to direct your attention and engage fully in what is relevant.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a bit more about the development of the mindfulness skills. What sort of things can people do to get this... get the task-focused attention, get the kind of mindfulness state that they want to have?
Well, the lovely thing is that, that there's an almost infinite number of ways of developing these skills. I mentioned that mindfulness is ancient, but until quite recently in the West, you could only really learn mindfulness skills through exotic ancient pathways like meditation or yoga or Tai Chi or martial arts. You know, with an approach like acceptance and commitment therapy, there are so many different ways that you can develop these mindfulness skills. And there's kind of three core skills that I describe in the confidence gap. One is engagement, what we've just been talking about, the ability to engage your attention fully in what you're doing. One is diffusion, which is the ability to kind of separate or detach from thoughts that pop in your head and let them come and go like passing cars. And one of them is expansion, this idea of opening up and making room for painful, uncomfortable thoughts and feelings so they can flow through you without holding you back. Probably one of the simplest, quickest mindfulness techniques is to learn is just some very simple diffusion techniques. We've probably got time to go through a couple of these.
Yeah, sure.
What I'd encourage the listener to do is bring to mind a nasty negative self-judgment. You know, we're all walking around with multiple versions of the I'm not good enough story. And it's incredibly common. You know, I mentioned I run workshops and training for psychologists and other health professionals all over Australia. Trained about 10,000 psychological health professionals in the last 5 years, and at every workshop I'm training, I say, can I get a show of hands up if there is anyone in this room that can put their hand up and honestly say that they do not have some version of the I'm not good enough story that shows up and gives them a good kicking at times. Mm-hmm. And to date, not one person has ever put their hand up. You know, we're all walking around with the I'm not good enough story. For most people, it starts in childhood. Some people a little bit in later life. And it's the best kept secret on the planet. We all have it, but you're not really allowed to talk about it.
It's ironic, isn't it? Everyone's walking around with this, but nobody's like wants to admit.
Yeah, exactly. Like in Australia, if someone says, how are you? What do you have to say?
Oh, I'm good.
What's the most negative you're allowed to be?
Well, not bad.
Not bad, exactly. What happens if you say, "Oh, I'm feeling like a complete worthless loser"? Yeah.
Oh, he's being
Oh.
honest with me.
So we've all got this, and I love kind of, teasing the professional audiences. And well, you folks, you're all psychological health professionals. Shouldn't you have gotten rid of this story by now? All your positive thinking and so forth, and but we've all got this "I'm not good enough" story, but it's kind of well kept secret. And so what I'll ask your listeners to do is to bring to mind some version of the "I'm not good enough" story, some version of it that you feel holds you back in some way from doing the things that are important and meaningful in your heart.
Well, let's maybe run a scenario, because let me throw you a scenario. Say, a guy's out there and he sees a woman that he's attracted to, and he'd like to go and talk to her, but immediately his head goes into, "I'm not good enough. She's not going to want to talk to me." Let's use that as a scenario.
Okay. Look, sure. What probably the easiest thing though is what I was going to say is ask the I'm asking the listeners if they can bring to mind some personal version of that story that shows up in their life today, because not all of them are in that situation. So,
Sure.
whatever version of this story is holding you back most. So it might be, I mean, it takes many different forms. It might be, "I'm boring," or "I'm stupid," or "I'm fat," or "I'm incompetent," or "I'm unlovable," or "I can't do this," or "I can't cope with that," or "I'm not enough of this." And I'll ask your listeners to put this into a short sentence, put it into the kind of most judgmental form that this story takes, and keep it short. "I am X," or "I am not Y enough." I'm too stupid," or "I'm not smart enough." Keep it short and sweet so you can work with it. What I'm going to ask next is that for about 10 seconds, I'm going to ask you to buy into this thought. Believe it as much as you possibly can. This is the very opposite of what you've been told to do. Everyone tells you to try and get rid of these thoughts. But it's very important for this exercise. I want you, first of all, to have the experience of what it's like to get completely sucked in by that thought, pulled into it. The technical term for this in ACT is fusion. So I'm going to get you to fuse with the thought. So don't challenge it or dispute it or push it away. I'm going to ask you for 10 seconds to buy into it, believe it as much as possible. And then I'm going to take you through some defusion techniques to give you the experience of separating or detaching from the thought. So I'll do this with you, Graham, and you don't have to share what the story is, although you can if you want to.
Sure.
So I'll get you to just bring to mind a nasty negative self-judgment.
Got it.
And for 10 seconds now, just buy into it, believe it as much as possible. Really buy into it. Now I'll get you to repeat that thought to yourself with a phrase in front. The phrase is this: "I am having the thought that." So say it to yourself again, "I'm having the thought that I'm a loser. I'm having the thought that I'm incompetent." Now I'll get you to say it again one more time. The phrase is a little bit longer. "I notice I'm having the thought that." Okay, so "I notice I'm having the thought that I'm boring," or whatever. So what happens as you do that?
I noticed that the first time when I just focused on fusing with a thought, I felt an anxious feeling in my stomach, a kind of butterfly, jittery unpleasantness. When I added the "I'm having the thought" and then "I noticed that I'm having the thought," I felt that feeling kind of dissipate. It was like I wasn't taking it so seriously anymore.
Sense of kind of separation from the thought or detachment from the thought.
Yes. It was
And so
less.
this is, well, this is what we call diffusion. So that's kind of one of the main mindfulness skills. If you think of two sheets of metal fused together, there's no separation there. They're just fused. They're stuck. They're welded. So defusion. So when we talk about fusion with our thoughts, what we mean is no separation. You're totally caught up in them. They're having a huge impact and influence over you. Defusion means we start to separate or detach from our thoughts. We start stepping back from them, recognizing that they are thoughts. They are words and pictures that pop into our head. And In the ACT model, we never ever get into debates about whether thoughts are true or false, unlike models such as CBT, because the ACT model rests on a concept called workability, which asks the question, is what you're doing working to give you a rich, full and meaningful life?
Mm-hmm.
If it is, then keep doing it. If it's not, then do something different. And when we work from a concept called workability, we never have to get into debates about whether thoughts are true or false. We just simply ask the question, when this thought pops into your head, if you hold on tightly to it, if you get all caught up in it, if you let it dictate what you do with your arms and your legs, then will that help to give you a rich, full and meaningful life?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's true or false isn't the issue.
That's more about, is it helpful or unhelpful?
Yeah. Yeah, is it helpful to hold on to this thought or not? Does it, the nature of the human mind is that it thinks negatively, and all the positive thinking in the world can help you think a bit more positively, but it's not going to stop your mind from creating negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so diffusion is a strategy for dealing with those negative thoughts. What about expansion?
Well, expansion is it's kind of a little bit more of a tricky one. A kind of simple starting point would be, I talked before about mindfulness is a state of curiosity and openness.
Mm-hmm.
And as we start to pay attention to these feelings in our body with this kind of open curiosity, if you were to notice this feeling in your body the same way like a young child might study a ladybird under a magnifying glass with that same kind of curiosity, and just pick one part of this feeling that you're struggling with, that pressure in the chest or that knot in your stomach, and just kind of sit and study it for a few minutes and notice all the different sensations, the temperature, the pulsation, the movement. See if you can discover something new in it that you never noticed before. And while you're doing that, breathe into it, and it's as if your breath just flows into and around the feeling. If you like, assuming you're in the privacy of your own room, another thing you can do is just gently place a hand over the feeling. Mm-hmm. Just feel the warmth flow from your hand into that feeling in your chest or your tummy or wherever it is, and see if you can just get a sense of softening up or loosening up around it. These are a kind of simple practices that can help you start changing your relationship, recognizing that you don't have to fight or struggle with this. It's hard to really explain it in a short space of time. It really involves sitting down and actually doing these exercises.
And I'm guessing this is why you run workshops to teach people how to do this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of my workshops are for professionals, but I have started running workshops now for the general public. They're actually called happiness trap workshops, but confidence is a kind of theme within those workshops.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'd like to go back a step and talk about something you touched on very briefly earlier, which is about failure and the fear that we often have around failure. Like, where does that come from, and what do we do about that?
Well, I think, the reality is failure hurts. It really does. And as kids, we learn from a young age that, kids that succeed in achieving their goals get more praise, more rewards, more attention, and from a very young age we feel that pain when we see other kids succeeding more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we're in a culture that's obsessed with achieving goals. Another one of the themes in the confidence gap is asking people to redefine success, because generally we think of success as achieving goals. But there is a different way of thinking about it, which is success is living by your values. Mm-hmm. And if you adopt that as your definition, then you can actually have instant success, because right now in this moment, I can live by my values, stand for something important, be the person I want to be, even if the goals I want to achieve are a long way off, or even if I never achieve them, I can still stand for something and be the person I want to be. A very good example of this is Martin Luther King. By conventional notions of success, he was not successful. He didn't achieve his dream of equality for blacks in America. There's still huge amount of discrimination and prejudice, although it's come a long way. But if we define success as living by your values, well, Martin Luther King was an incredibly successful guy. Fear, I mean, failure hurts, and naturally we don't like kind of pain, and so we try to avoid it or get rid of it. Sometimes parents help us a little bit. They say things, like it's taking part that counts, and that's a nice thing to say, but the messages that we get from the media and television and magazines, it's all about achievement, 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 right?
So you're suggesting that being congruent with a person's values is more important, and if you define that as your quality for success, then you can be successful straight away.
Absolutely. By that definition, let's suppose you have a mother who decides to give up her career to stay home and look after the kids because she really values being supportive, available, nurturing, loving. Let's suppose her husband has the same values, but he instead pursues his career and becomes the CEO of a multinational organization earning millions and billions of dollars, but he's never there for the kids. Mm-hmm. So to society at large, he would seem to be the successful one by the conventional notion of success. But if we look at it in terms of living by the values, actually his wife has been far more successful.
Yeah, I think learning to deal with failure is an interesting one, because even with the conventional definitions, a lot of people that are we consider conventionally successful have actually had to deal with a lot of conventional failure in order to get there. So if we're not allowed to let ourselves fail at things, then there's a lot of things we can't be successful at.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well said. In fact, by conventional notions of success, those people have had a huge amount of failures to get there. And so this is another thing where expansion comes in useful. This is a key skill. Expansion really is about learning how to accept or drop the struggle with pain in whatever form it takes. That may be the pain of failure or the pain of fear. Interestingly, your capacity to accept pain directly relates to your long-term happiness level. The less your ability to accept painful feelings, the less your long-term happiness, because the things that make life rich, full, and meaningful and give rise to genuine, lasting happiness give you all sorts of painful feelings.
Fascinating. So your ability to endure pain actually correlates with your ability to be happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's lots of research for this. Technical term for what we're talking about here is experiential avoidance. Experiential avoidance is the ongoing attempt to avoid or get rid of painful or unpleasant feelings. And the higher your level of experiential avoidance, in other words, the more your life is focused around trying to avoid or get rid of painful or unpleasant feelings, the greater your risk of depression, anxiety disorders, drug addiction, developing post-traumatic stress disorder after a stressful incident, work disability, the list just goes on and on and on and on and on. If you just take something as simple as having children, having children adds a huge amount of meaning and purpose and fulfillment to your life. And it gives you some wonderful feelings of love and joy, feelings that you never realized you could have. Beautiful, beautiful feelings, but also give you, ask any parent, feelings, other feelings of frustration, rage, anxiety, guilt, exhaustion. And if you think about any kind of really big, meaningful life project, it gives rise to that full range of human emotions. I often say to my clients, if you want to live a full human life, you'll need to learn how to feel the full range of human emotions. If we come back to the scenario you gave before, asking a girl on a date, let's suppose that you're successful and that blooms into a relationship. Well, even the best of relationships, they give you lovely feelings of love and tenderness, but then there's all the other feelings of fear and anxiety and the strife that relationships bring, and not getting your needs met, and frustration and miscommunication. And, you know, no wonder Jean-Paul Sartre said hell is other people.
So it's kind of like a complete package. You can't just have the happiness without copying the other stuff as well.
No, exactly. And that's why the first book was called The Happiness Trap, because, you know, most people's notion of happiness is it's the same as feeling good. And if that's your idea of happiness, you're going to be struggling with reality big time.
Right, yeah, I hear where you're coming from. So yeah. What can we do then to increase this ability to handle pain and discomfort that allows us to have the joy and the happiness as well?
Well, the thing is, two things really. You know, the app model is based on two key streams. One is clarifying your values and using your values to guide your actions. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing: when you act in line with your own deepest core values, that is intrinsically rewarding. In other words, the acting on those values is its own reward. Regardless of what the outcome is, when I'm kind of, let's suppose I want to stand for something in this relationship, like being loving and caring and compassionate, for example. Mm-hmm. As I kind of act in a manner that is loving and caring, compassionate, it's intrinsically rewarding. So one stream in ACT is clarifying your values and letting them guide and influence your actions and guide the goals that you pursue. And the second stream is mindfulness not only to make room for the difficult thoughts and feelings, but also to engage fully in whatever you are doing. If you want to get the maximum pleasure and enjoyment out of life, you need to be fully engaged in what you're doing. We've all had the experience of eating a lovely meal, and after the first couple of mouthfuls, we just get lost in the conversation or the movie or the book or something like that, and we hardly taste the food. Whereas when you have that first mouthful and you're really noticing the food, it's so much more enjoyable and tasty. It's an incredibly positive and optimistic approach to life. It assumes that no matter what is happening in your life, you have a capacity to find satisfaction and fulfillment. But it only comes from dropping those conventional notions of having to avoid or get rid of pain. If I get in touch with my values and live by my values and engage in what I'm doing, then life can be fulfilling even in moments of great pain. Now, Stephen Hayes is the creator of the ACT model, psychologist based in America, and you know, he has a very nice saying. He says there's as much life in a moment of pain as in a moment of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so can we embrace each moment of life, whether it's a moment of pain or a moment of joy? So we're going to get plenty of both.
And you're saying that the more we allow ourselves to feel the whole range of emotions, then the more we're able to experience the highs and the lows and live a more fulfilling life ultimately.
Absolutely.
Okay, that sounds great, Russ. Look, I really appreciate you spending time with me today. You've given us some fantastic tips on confidence. So if anyone wants to get in touch with you to learn more about your book or your workshops, where's the best place for them to go to?
The website is www.thehappinesstrap.com. And they can find out there about professional workshops, happiness trap workshops, my books, all of it there. So it's thehappinesstrap.com.
Great. Okay. Well, look, thank you once again. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Graham. It's a pleasure.